Tim Call is my first guest. Tim Call is the vice president of the Sacramento Poetry Center. He's also one of the primary coordinators of the terrific reading series that they have there, which I strongly encourage you to check out without explicitly telling you what to do. Every Monday night at the Sacramento Poetry Center, you'll find different local or traveling poets who will entertain and enthuse you about their particular work. You'll be invited to read often at an open mic afterwards, and you'll see a lot of great books and paintings around there as well. So I'll make sure that Tim Call says something about the Sacramento Poetry Center. He's the author of a new book called The Century of Travel. That's from CW Books. His previous book to that, Possessing Yourself from Word Tech, is also well known to local poetry lovers. His work has been published in Prairie Schooner, American Letters and Commentary, Berkeley Poetry Review, 14 Hills, George Washington Review, Illuminations, Indiana Review. I could go on and on. So I shall. Limestone, Nimrod, Ninth Letter, Notre Dame Review, South Dakota Quarterly, etc., etc. I think, like our mutual friend Joshua McKinney, that when he gets to 100 journals, he's just going to put down 100 or more journals, and then he can pick out a few of his favorites. He's translated German poet Rolf Hauff's, Austrian avant-gardist Friederike Mayrocker, Brazilian poets Ledo Ivo and Marley Oliveira, and the poems of the Portuguese language's only Nobel laureate, José Saramago. He also appears as Victor Schnickelfritz at the video poetry book review and poetics blog The Great American Pinup. Tim Call is the editor for Bald Trickster Press, which is dedicated to works of poetry and translation from other languages into English. You can find out more about Tim Call at timcall.com. That's KAHL.com. He's also the author of The Century of Travel, which I have right here. Tim Call, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Oh, hurrah. Thank you, Andy. And I'll have to make sure I cut that intro down or find out who's responsible for putting it up on the internet in such an elongated fashion.
Yes, I usually blame the staff of this radio show. So if you'd like to do that, that's fine with me.
They'll be the first ones whose head will roll.
Certainly. Great to have you on this radio show. I didn't really go into too much detail because it's not listed here in your official bio about your longstanding relationship in a number of different offices at the Sacramento Poetry Center. And before we go any further, I'm wondering if you could tell folks what the Sacramento Poetry Center is, where it could be found, and how we find out more about your offerings there.
The Sacramento Poetry Center is being dubbed these days as Sacramento's oldest literary resource. It goes all the way back to 1979, so it's been around in Sacramento for over 30 years. And as various different members and board members come and go, it takes on various different missions. But the one that stays central is that it is a weekly offering of, like you said, local or poets who've come through the area to come and read their work, oftentimes associated with the new books that they have, and sometimes not. So it's a nice mix of both the local and reaching out beyond the community and having other poets come through who are interesting for pretty much a general audience. Sometimes we have academic poets that come through, but, not necessarily. And the thing that I praise it for is that I believe, I'm not absolutely up to date on all of this stuff, but it has to be one of the very few venues in the country that has weekly readings and has been doing it for, literally decades. The only one I can think of that, does such madness is maybe the Bowery Poetry Club in New York City. And so it has, that kind of distinction about it. It kind of also, I think, is partly to blame or to praise for the fact that Sacramento, to a large extent, its literary tradition, if you will, is not so much a publication-oriented one, but one that's more performance oriented. And just as, you know, the Poetry Center has been in place at a weekly basis for many years, so has Luna's. So we are, you know, which is a bar on 16th Street that specializes also in a weekly reading series. So we have two weekly venues in Sacramento that I dare say is a pretty rare phenomenon in the United States.
Absolutely. And Luna's does poetry on Thursday nights. You all do poetry at the Sacramento Poetry Center on Monday nights.
On Monday nights, that's right. Every Monday night you'll find us there, except for the Monday, you know, before Christmas, the 24th. We'll take that off this year.
That's reasonable.
Yeah.
And those readings start at 7:30?
7:30 is correct.
And where do we go online for more information?
SacramentoPoetryCenter.org. And the actual premise is located at 1719 25th Street. So it's in between P&Q on 25th.
Excellent. All right, good. Now that we've got that out of the way, let's ask Tim Call about his new book, The Century of Travel. I'm wondering about the title. Certainly you've traveled linguistically with all of the translations that you've done, and I'm wondering if some of those influences and topics also come up in your most recent book of poetry.
Well, to a certain extent. I'm thinking about travel in a lot of different ways, not only just the idea of being able to put oneself in motion and move from place to place, but also the idea of people migrating over time, species migrating, ideas migrating, and, you know, things like music migrating. For example, one of the poems, the very last poem in the book, is called Schlummerlied. And in that particular piece, I went to the thrift store and found an old songbook from the turn of the 20th century. It was a 1898 copyright. And it had a bunch of songs that had probably come over through previous waves of immigration. And I started to play some of those and was enchanted with this Schlummerlied, which from the German means basically slumber song or cradle song, lullaby. And then found that though the melody was enchanting, the words that accompanied them seemed a bit dated. So the poem is a reworking of the lyrics from that particular tune to reflect the digital age. So I like to think of it as the first digital age lullaby. And in doing that, you know, you kind of get the sense of this bringing this music through the century to come to a new place here at the beginning of the 21st century.
Excellent. The book, The Century of Travel, also has three parts, one of which is called, do you pronounce it, Herophony?
Herophony is correct, yes.
Herophony, and what I love as the host of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour is the way that you connect poetry and technology right in the start of the book with the two epigraphs that we find here. The 19th century was a gigantic machine for uprooting countrymen by Eric Hobsbawm, mm-hmm. is one, and the other by Claude Debussy. The century of airplanes has a right to its own music, which I think is terrific. I should, we were talking about the staff of this radio show. I should get them to excerpt these and put these up somewhere on the website, because I think they do well to mix poetry and technology.
Well, you know, I like to think of myself as an early adopter for a number of online things. You know, I'm not so as quick to adopt anymore just because I find that I've reached a point of data smog, you know, where I can't keep up with all the various different streams that one can potentially juggle throughout the day, and it gets to be cumbersome. But, you know, it is important in the book to look at how we are able to, you know, literally travel throughout the world in real time through the Internet, through the use of cameras that are attached to the Internet. And that is really unthinkable. You know, the basic premise for the book is what would somebody standing at the beginning of the 20th century think about our ability to kind of peek in and be voyeurs around the world? And I think it's pretty astonishing, and maybe the thing that, that marks our cultural moment more than anything else.
So. I think you're right. I'm also curious to know, with regard to technology and trying to keep up with the data streams, you're a data stream producer as well as consumer. I know that I've seen you post a thing or two on Facebook. You also have a website. You talked about your blog, which uses a different persona to mm-hmm. review books of poetry. And I'm wondering what have been your own strategies and priorities with regard to how you are going to present yourself online yeah. for others to find you.
I don't know if I'm a very good marketer and strategize about things, but I do think it's important that you do have an online presence. You know, particularly if you're doing anything that's performance oriented or you know, that has to do with the arts, you have to be able to be have people find you. You know, early on when I started my blog in like 2004, 2005, it was actually a collective blog at that point in time. I really was just doing it out of a sense of fun to see what we could do with the technology. And then that, you know, migrated to a position where I started to do a lot of video work and would post a lot of the readings that happened at the Poetry Center and other readings, and that led to the Line Break Studios blog, where there are many, many different videos from SPC and around the country. You know, on Facebook in particular, where I think it's a great marketing tool, but it's easy to get sucked into the abyss too. I try to treat it just as that, as a marketing tool, not to try to make it too much as a kind of place to, you know, be a social gab fest, if you will.
Right.
So there are strengths. I think it's easy to get sucked into the technology where it becomes a huge time sink. And that's basically why I generally stopped doing the video to a large extent, just because it became so time-consuming to do all the video editing. But, you know, it's out there, too. That's the beautiful thing about being online, is that once you do something, it ostensibly lives there for you know, as long as somebody is there to maintain it. And like with literary magazines, many people have found that, you know, actually as they start to have online incarnations, it's kind of handy to go back and look at that sixth or seventh issue ago to see who was in that. It gives you a nice sense of how the magazine may have changed or what continuity there is. You know, when it was just a print culture, you know, people would print these things, they would be in circulation for 6 to 8 months, and then they'd ostensibly disappear.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Call. He's vice president of the Sacramento Poetry Center and the author of a brand new book called The Century of Travel. It's from CW Books. You can find out more about Tim Call at timcall.com. Tim, we're going to take a quick break to hear a public service announcement. Sure. And then when we return, I'm hoping that you'll share with us a radio-ready example of your work in this great new book, The Century of Travel. We'll be right back with more of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Tim Call is my guest right now, and we're waiting to hear a poem from The Century of Travel. It's his most recent book from CW Books. He's also author of the book Possessing Yourself from WordTech in 2009. Tim, what's the poem that you'd like to share with listeners this afternoon?
Well, I can't decide between birds or cars, so I think because it's Century of Travel, maybe we'll stick with the car theme.
Excellent. And The Century of Travel, that's the name of your new book of poetry, right?
That is correct. That is correct. Century of Travel. This speaks to the notion of how the highways, in many respects, are the public square. This is called California Poppies. California poppies line the highway embankments. The orange and yellow sneezed onto the green grass and contaminating the thoughts of drivers too heavily invested in the traffic. They drive to be free, but they cannot escape the feeling they were born to wait in lines moving so slow. They are the crowd in a parade of onlookers, and they are the spectacle, too. Stopped in all lanes, they stare back at each other. Their faces sit behind glass like exhibits of stunned fish just recovering from a feeding frenzy. Well, the worst is over. The best is gesturing from up the road ahead. A man in a uniform is steering everyone around the collision of two minivans. Soon the slowdown will open up again, and the cars will course through the meadows to Placerville. And on both sides are the poppies that infect the heads of the onlookers with dreams. They will dream the MGM dreams of a sleeping Dorothy who wakes when the snow begins to fall on her. It is some distance yet to the covered peaks of the mountains. But in the meantime, it is nice to know there is still some magic between there and the city behind them, even if it is only the magic of believing the highway can blindly lead a person to the land of Oz.
I like how you threw Oz in the end there. And I really enjoyed that poem. I'm wondering, though, if that would not have been an occasion for a song, because I know sometimes you'll throw in a verse or two of sung poetry, as it were, right in the middle of one of your poems.
Oh, yeah, that's been something that I've been working on and playing with for a number of years, really, as I've tried to adopt more of a kind of performance notion with a lot of the things that I write. You know, I started writing mostly surrealist and more avant-garde type writing. I think to write in the academy to a certain extent and be accepted by these literary magazines, you have to learn how narrative works. But in Sacramento, what I've learned primarily is how to bring some sort of performative edge to the work that you're doing. And for me, that just happens to be song, because for me, one of the great aphorisms or maxims about poetry that I carry around with me is Ezra Pounds, who said that, you know, the farther poetry moves from music, the lesser it becomes. And I just tried to do it quite literally, to bring music into the poems, to try to, you know, help the poem be something more than just something you throw into a public venue that is read in a rather, you know, somber reading voice, which oftentimes, as you've been to many poetry readings, can be a bit cumbersome as an audience.
Absolutely. And so you lighten it up, but also provide surprises, which is not only great in poetry, it's also the root of successful humor.
I think that I try to use song in both a surprising manner and then also in a way that people can find them to be cultural touchstones, too. I don't generally, crib, if you will, pop songs too much because I haven't had the test of time. But I like to go back and, you know, particularly folk songs, things that people can recognize immediately for the most part. Although I was rudely, awakened to the fact that some people aren't familiar with Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. When I did that in one of my poems, I thought that was, what have we come to when somebody can't recognize that great Negro spiritual? But for the most part, they're tunes that people should be able to pick up on as cultural touchstones. And if they don't, then, well, you know, they have the opportunity to go and look them up and see where they come from as well.
My children have told me many times, often with pained and anxious expressions, how familiar they are with Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, or at least my interpretation thereof.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing I've tried to have to learn to do is, you know, I'd never sung before in public before I started to do these kinds of things that where they interjected in poems. and I found the key to making it at least passable. I'm not saying that my voice is going to be something that you're going to see anybody lining up to see in Mondavi Hall anytime soon. But, rehearsal is really important. And I don't think poets in general try to rehearse very much. In fact, I've had poets that I've had invited who said, oh, well, I like to just read it fresh when I get there. And I said, I wish you wouldn't do that, you know.
Right. Don't stumble through
a,
quotes, performance just to keep it fresh.
Right.
Try acting fresh while you read something that you're actually familiar and comfortable with.
Yeah, well, also, too, you become much more familiar if you've done much recitation. And this is another thing that I've tried to take on to help me with bringing in a certain kind of phrasing to my own work when I read it, is by memorizing things, it starts to play in your head like a piece of memorized music that you might play in a classical repertoire, where it is all about interpretation at that point in time. And how you bring your voice up and down and pacing and dynamics and, all of these things hopefully will make the piece stand out and be something that is, more remarkable than a poem that's read in that third grade voice. I don't know why this happens, but we all get our reading voice in about third grade handed to us from our third grade teacher and all of our peers, and we never seem to break out of it. We seem to be able to, have to feel that we have to read in this reading voice we've attained. And I'm curious why this has become a kind of cultural phenomenon. If we feel that we just can't, break out and do something that's going to draw attention to ourselves or what. But I know you've seen it many times, but most poets have a reading voice that they, very much contain themselves in. And it doesn't make much sense to me.
Yeah, I came home from college, I think, after my sophomore year, totally enamored with T.S. Eliot, and would read poems to my little brother. And it had such an effect on him that he went on to study poetry, if only to find a different way of performing poetry from the way that I performed it to him.
Yeah.
So, and he was successful and a big prize winner in that endeavor. So all of us need someone to emulate and someone to run away from. And it sounds like your running to a song has helped you distinguish yourself from the third grade voiced pack of folks who sometimes show up to poetry readings.
Well, I there's a couple of different reasons why I've tried to take it on. And those two ideas, the cultural touchstone and making your voice different from the kind of 3 or 4 or 5 note range that you often find are two of the reasons. But also another reason I found I wanted to do it is if you're reading things that, at least pretend to have a certain level of intellectual weight or heft to them. And in the academy, sometimes you feel compelled to do such things. Oftentimes you're accused of not having any particular heart in doing that. And I found that those criticisms went away as soon as I got up and started to sing Schubert or something along these lines. I figured, well, if he can get up and make a fool out of himself doing that, then apparently he must believe pretty much in what he's doing. So has that effect as well.
Absolutely. It's worked for actors for a long time. Why not the rest of us?
That's right. Absolutely.
Tim Call has been my guest for the first half hour of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. I encourage all of you to check out his new book, The Century of Travel. He's also the author of Possessing Yourself. Information on these available at timcall.com. Tim, it's always a pleasure to talk to you about poetry and other topics. Thanks so much for agreeing to come on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Well, thank you for having me. I'll give you one last plug, and that is I'll be reading at Luna's tomorrow night at 8:30-ish. That's at 1414 16th Street, and it should be a fun-packed evening. You'll get to hear little bits and pieces of all the things that we've talked about.
That's great. So that's tomorrow at Luna's, the Juice Bar. Tell us again the address in Sacramento.
It's at 1414 16th Street.
And what time does that start?
In downtown. It's billed at 8. I suspect it'll probably be more 8:30-ish to 8:45-ish before I'll get on.
Excellent. All right. Well, Tim, thanks so much, and I will see you soon.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
Take care.
Take care.